Okay, so I think we're just about at quarter past, so we will kick off, I think, if that's okay with you. Good afternoon. Thanks for coming. My name is Mike Talty. I work for Microsoft in the UK. I'm part of the developer and platform group over there in the UK. I've got all my contact details up here, so if you want to mail me or find me on Twitter or find me on the web or something like that, then all of that stuff's there. Do feel very free to take that down and use it any which way you want to use it. Don't abuse it too much, but feel free to make use of those things. That's what they are there for. We're going to spend around about the next 70 or so minutes talking around this idea of the Prism framework for Windows runtime specifically. A gentleman just at the front here did ask me, is this also going to cover other versions of Prism? There have been some other versions. We're really going to zoom in on the Windows runtime here, but I think some of the concepts and things will be very, very familiar across the different versions of Prism. Can I just check with you who you are? Are you people who are pretty much familiar with .NET? Is that something we can more or less assume? Yes, it is. Okay, cool. And C#, I think, probably goes in handy. Yeah. What about sort of XAML-based applications? Yeah, that's pretty much you too. It's just everybody in the room is putting their hands up for everything. Things like model view model, MVVM patterns, those kinds of things. Okay, great. And you know all around Prism for the Windows runtime already? Good, this is perfect. I was just checking, because we could have finished very early if you'd all put your hands up and said, yes, we are experts on this framework. Good, okay, so that's perfect. I think we should. I think we got just about the right people in the room, so thanks a lot for coming along. There's not going to be a lot of slides in this talk. Most of what we will do is work in Visual Studio, build something simple-ish, and then I will show you something more complex. So there's kind of two sides to what we'll do, but there's not a lot of PowerPoint, there's not a lot of pretty pictures or things like that. So it will require some concentration on your part to not get lost, but there's not that many of us, so if you do get lost at some point, just shout, and we'll try and do something about that and try and fix things as we go along. So what's this all about? It's always a good place to start. It's not this, by the way. This Prism term has... You can't put anything onto Twitter now about Prism without getting a whole bunch of people leaping onto you and abusing you. And this term has become sort of meaning something else. This is not what we're talking about. It's not that. So that's the main thing. It's this. What Prism is, and there have been different versions of Prism, and there still is version of Prism for WPF. That's still very much an active project. There's been versions of Prism for Silverlight, but the thing we're going to talk about here is Prism for the Windows runtime, for people who are building Windows Store applications. And if you came along, and I know some of you were at my talk yesterday about building for both Windows and Windows Phone, because of the increased presence of Windows runtime on Windows Phone, I think you can expect that Prism will expand itself out to not just be about Windows Store applications, but also about Windows Phone applications. That's not there just yet, but I think you can expect that that will happen over time because the Windows runtime is now pretty much common across those two platforms. So this stuff comes from the Microsoft Patterns and Practices team. So that's different from the people who build Visual Studio and the .NET framework. It's the guys who sit down and come up with what they think of as best patterns and practices for application development. Now, if those guys were to talk to you about their own framework, they would say that Prism is a framework for building business apps for the Windows Store. I wouldn't say that. I would say that Prism is a framework that you can use pieces of or all of for any Windows runtime application that you choose to build. They're very specific about saying, no, it's for business apps. I wouldn't say that at all. I think if you want to build a good quality app with a reliable framework, Prism's something you can use in any context, not just if you're building a business application. So I think it's fine for consumer applications as well. It really does target .NET, XAML, and the model view model pattern. So if you were building your Windows Store applications in, for instance, HTML and JavaScript, some of what Prism gives you will be applicable, but not at the framework level, not at the class library level. So you will get some guidance from Prism, but you won't get class libraries. So they're not the version of Prism, if you like, for HTML and JavaScript developers. It's really living in the world of C#, XAML, .NET development. And there are versions, as it says on the slide, for Windows 8.0 and a modified version for Windows 8.1. And it is a modified version. It's slightly different from the version that the guys shipped for Windows 8.0. Where you go to get it is a link at the bottom of the screen. Of course, you can just type Prism Windows Runtime into your favorite search engine, or you can just go to prismwindowsruntime.coblex.com. And that's where you can get almost all of the bits that I'm going to show you today. I'm going to use one other thing today. I'll talk about it briefly, that you don't get from that site. And I'll just point out what that is when we talk about it. So what do you get? What's this all about? The real idea here with Prism is to give you guidance and framework and also a reference implementation to help you build flexible, maintainable, testable, quality applications. If you want to hack together an application very, very quickly, Prism might not be for you. It really is around high quality, maintainable, flexible, nicely abstracted applications where we've got very clear separation of concerns across a UI layer, a logic layer, and a set of services that underpin that logic layer. So it's very, very specific about how you might structure an application. In doing that, the people who built the Prism framework and the guidance wanted to address some of the common concerns of a Windows Store application. So things like suspending, resuming, and terminating. Things like settings. Things like portrait and landscape orientation. Things like navigation. Those kinds of things that you have to do in a Windows Store app, the Prism guys have tried to give you framework pieces and guidance around all those things. And really, I think the point at the bottom is a very good one, a consistent architectural infrastructure. And coming back to your question about other versions of Prism, that was true for those versions too. And really, the way I see this is if I build an app and I ask you to come and work on my code base, if I've just gone my own way, the chances are you're going to spend maybe a day or two trying to figure out what I've been doing, how I go about navigation, how I go about suspending state, how I go about handling settings, and these kinds of things. If you've built on top of a framework like Prism, the idea is that I should be able to come to your code base, and it should look kind of familiar to me when I arrive there. Because as a Prism app, I'm going to know that you've structured your app a certain way, that you're relying on certain services from Prism. And so when I come to your framework, when I come to your implementation with Prism, it's not going to look completely alien to me, and you've not gone off in a million different ways doing your own things. We would kind of have a common language to talk about, just as we have a common language in .NET, just as we have a common language in XAML, and so on and so forth. And I think that's a really important one, that you've got this idea of consistency in the way that things are implemented. So what does this give you? Well, it gives you four things, really, three of which we'll really talk about perhaps in the session here. It gives you a bunch of documentation, and I'm going to really try to emphasize the documentation. Does anyone like reading documentation? You and me. Okay, just the one gentleman. but I really, with Prism, want to emphasize this for you. It doesn't get emphasized enough. There is a bunch of goodness. If you never build your application with the Prism framework, still read the documentation. Make an informed choice. That's fine. You know, go off and do your own thing. But there's a bunch of stuff that would apply to any mobile application development, and specifically Windows Store mobile application development, in the Prism documentation. And I think, for me, I'd be very happy to see it sort of pop up in Visual Studio at the point where you're making a new project and say, hey, by the way, you might want to read this. It's a really good set of documentation. I'll just give you a picture on it in 1 second. But I really am trying to emphasize, I recommend reading this. You don't have to read it all. You don't have to read it all in one go, but it really is useful. You also get, and this is where most people would probably start as developers, this is what we do, you get a bunch of class libraries and source code, so you'll probably all leap in there, throwing the documentation to one side. But you get a bunch of class libraries and source code. You get some quick starts. There's not a ton of quick starts, but you get 3 or 4 quick starts for particular feature areas. And then very importantly, and some of you might prefer this approach to the documentation approach, you get an implementation of what they call a reference application. So the Prism guys, and we'll look at it a little bit later on, have built an application. It's a sort of businessy application, I guess. They've implemented all the code. They've implemented all the unit tests. They've implemented the back-end web services. They shipped the whole thing built on their framework so that if you're thinking, hey, how do you do how do you data bind a view model onto a flyout? How do you do that? You can poke into their reference application and have a look how they did it. And it's meant to imply best practice. It's meant to be something that you can look at and replicate in your own environments. So I think that's a very useful thing that they ship. And we'll look at it. We'll take a vertical slice and look at it a little bit towards the end of the session. We can't look at all of it. It's quite big. In terms of, I'll do this again. I should tell you about this. Today, I'm going to be using Prism project templates in Visual Studio. They don't ship these when you download from Codeplex. They come from a separate site, and they're pretty easy to find. I find them really useful because it lets you do File, New Project in Visual Studio, and you get, if you like, a Prism application as opposed to just a blank application that you then have to turn into a Prism application. So I find this really useful. It also has some item templates as well, and we'll see those as we go along. So I would recommend using these if you want to build with Prism. I think they're really good. Again, just to hammer the point home about this documentation, what do you get in the way of documentation? Well, essentially, you get this thing over here, Prism for the Windows Runtime for Windows 8.0 or 8.1, developing a Windows Store business app with C#, XAML, and Prism. And to break that down for you, I'm probably frightening the life out of you, it is 250 pages, but you don't have to read it all. You're going to love this. You're going to go crazy with this. It's very much broken down into different sections, and some of this documentation is really explaining, hey, this is what happens in this quick start. Here's what happens in the other quick start. I don't think most people are going to read those and memorize them. But you can jump around in there. They've got great guidance for some of the topics and more that we've got on the screen. How do you deal with navigation? How do you deal with suspend resume? How do you deal with touch input? How do you deal with view models? How do you deal with injecting services with dependency injection? And so on and so forth. There's lots and lots and lots of stuff in there. I would really recommend you have a look at if you are building these applications. Have I labored this enough now? Have I beaten you enough with the documentation stick? I should have printed the book and hit you with it. And read this book. I think it's really good, if you haven't noticed already. I think it's really good. Okay, so it's a book. And then what you get... Sure.
Is it a PDF?
It's a PDF, yeah. Yeah. Then what you get is a bunch of class libraries and source code. And you can get this separately from NuGet, so you can go to NuGet and you can type in Prism and you can get the libraries that way as well, or you can go to Codeplex and get them that way. That's only one of them, actually, that happens. There is another one for loosely coupled events, but this is the primary package on NuGet. And you'll see some extensions below for making Prism work nicely with specific inversion of control containers. Inversion control containers, that's what I'm trying to say. Like Winsor and AutoFac and so on. We will use AutoFac in this session, but we won't use this particular package off NuGet to use it. We'll just do it ourselves, which is pretty easy. You don't have to go too far with that. Okay, so I think that's pretty much the end of the slides and the introduction, really. We're going to build out a little application, and then we'll take a look at the Prism reference application. The application we're going to build looks like this, or it will do when we finish it. I wanted to try and put this up on the screen so that you understand what it is we're trying to get to, because there's a few moving parts in this as we build it along. The idea is just to be the world's simplest contact information sort of application. That's the idea of it. It's deliberately simple. And so what we've got on the screen here, just to illustrate some of the pieces that we will be building as we go along, this is going to be a view called the Contacts page, which I thought was a reasonable name for it. And there will be a view model behind this providing the data, and we will call that the Contacts page view model. It'll be providing a collection of contacts, as you might expect. This page is going to rely on a couple of services. When you tap on a contact, we will navigate to another page. So we will need a navigation service to do that. And we're going to build a little service to load and save contacts from the disk. So we'll have a persistence service for that. Each one of these contacts is represented by a contact view model. So we're going to have a contact view model for that. And then, as I said, you can tap on one of these things where we will invoke a command, which I called the invoke command. And when you tap on one of these things, it will navigate you to a details page. Here's the details page where you can actually change a few things. So this is the details page. Behind this, we will have a details page view model. And there's a button over in the right bottom right-hand corner on the application bar. Oh, sorry, this will also need a persistent service to load the data and a navigation service in case you want to go back. It's only two pages in this application. And then down in the bottom right on the application bar, there will be a save button, which will invoke a save command. Kind of make sense? Okay. I felt if I just dropped into XAML, it was harder than if you'd seen some of these things before. So let's try and do that. And we'll do this in Visual Studio. So let's drop out of PowerPoint over here and drop into Visual Studio. And let's just bring that up. And we'll make a new project in here. Make a new project in here. And we'll just go to Windows Store down here. And I've installed those Prism app templates that I talked about, so I can make a Prism app. And we're going to call this demo code because I've got some namespaces later on that need the words demo code in them, or else it goes wrong. So let's see how we can do that. OK, so let me close these windows down for a second, and let's go to our Solution Explorer over here. The first thing I'm going to do is I'm just going to get rid of this view that we get for free, and I'm going to get rid of this view model that we get for free. And so those have gone. And all we've really got at the moment is an app.xaml and some code behind it and the few images that Visual Studio gives you for any application. You know, you've got these things here that you get for free. And obviously, references to Prism have been put in by the template, so that's quite nice. If we have a look at the app.xaml for a moment, just to show you kind of how this looks, the key thing here is you're not using the application class as it ships from sort of WinRT, if you like. We have a class from Prism called MVVMAppBase, which derives from that application class in WinRT. So we get a slightly different base class for our application. Has anyone ever made a blank Windows Store application? Who's used that template in Visual Studio? Oh, not so many of you. OK, cool. That's interesting. So if we have a look over here into app.xaml code behind file, I'm just going to get rid of a couple of things to simplify things even further just for the moment. Let's get rid of this. What I say is that, so again, you're deriving from this class called MVVMAppBase. We could just have a quick look at that with Alt+F12 in Visual Studio just to peek that definition. And you'll notice that it has some extra things. It derives from an application. That's the standard base class. But it adds some things like a navigation service, an extended splash screen, a session state service, and a bunch more overloads like onInitialize and onLaunch and a few other bits and pieces. But it's a base class derived from application. If you were to look at the standard blank application template in Visual Studio, I would argue strongly it's more complicated than that. There's almost nothing on the screen here. Obviously, we've got a blank application. You wouldn't expect a lot on the screen. But in the Visual Studio template, you would see more than this. This is very blank. It's very empty. To me, it's very clean and simple. If we press F5, hopefully that will not run. But we just need to tidy up those namespaces. Press F5 and run this thing up. It's a blank application. It's entirely functionally correct because it's a blank application, and that's a blank screen. So that's great. Very, very simple. I just want to show you a few things that happen as we run that application up. Let me just put a few breakpoints in here. So we'll add a few overrides. Let's say on window created. Let's override on launched. Let's override on initialize. Let's override register. On register known types for serialization. And let's just put a few breakpoints in here. Window created. Launched, initialize, register known types, launch application. Press F5 again. So there's a few steps going on in getting our application onto the screen. If you'd looked at a Windows 8.1 application, the first thing we do typically is create your window. And so that's still happening here. You can still override that. That's fine. And then the next thing we typically do is we call on launched for you. So this, again, is coming from the application base class itself. If you've ever handled onLaunched, it's a bit tedious because if you look at the typical boilerplate code that Visual Studio throws in for that, it will normally have code saying, am I being launched for the first time, or am I being launched when I'm already running? Well, that's a bit of a decision that not every application is necessary have to make. So Prism kind of overrides that and adds a specialized onInitialize function where you know this is actually the first time you're really being run. So you're actually being run for the first time onto the screen. And then finally, we end up in onLaunch applications. This is where the application's really starting up. And we run, and obviously it's still a blank application, as you would expect. Let me take away some of that complexity and go back to the simplicity we had before. Let's get rid of all that. I just wanted to show you that various things are happening on the way to getting the application on the screen. Let's add a quick and simple view. This one will be simple, just to kind of illustrate how this works. Let's add a new item in here, and we can probably filter this down a little bit to Prism items. And let's add a page view, and we'll call this one smileypage.xaml. So we'll add that into the thing. Let's add that in. And now we've got a smileypage.xaml. And let me just put something smiley on the page. So let me just wander down to the bottom of this grid. And let's see if we can insert a quick snippet of something relatively smiley. So that's my view, smileypage.xaml. Save that off. You'll notice that it's living in a folder called views. So what I can do if I want that to be the start page of my application, Prism, as we said, has a navigation service, so I can ask it to navigate to smiley. Let's press F5 and run that and see if we get our smiley face. We do, we get our smiley face. What's quite nice about this is that we just navigate with a string. We just say smiley and stuff happens and the smiley page type gets navigated to by the underlying framework, and we don't really have to worry about that. We just say, go to smiley, and off it goes. So there is a convention in play here that if you want a view that you can navigate to a string called smiley, then you will name that type smiley page and stick it into a views folder. That's the default convention. But as is the case in pretty much everything with Prism, there's a convention, but you can, of course, override it. So if you don't like the convention, you do what you want. And one of the ways you could do what you want, let's say, for instance, we say not smiley, for instance. Well, that's going to fail. That's not going to navigate to the right place. But what we could do is we could override something like get page type. Get page type is going to be called with smiley as a string, and it's got, sorry, not smiley as a string, and it has to figure out what to do. And we could say, well, we could fix this problem by simply saying so we take not smiley and turn it back into smiley and then ask the base class to do whatever it does with smiley, and we should be back and smiling again. So, you know, we can do whatever we want, but there is a convention in play that you can then manipulate if you want to. Let's make this smiley again, and let's get rid of this. So that's how the view kind of gets on the screen, but it's typical that you want to data bind a view to a view model, and there's a convention for that too. So let's make a quick, let's change the view. Let's see if we can find that yellow color somewhere in the view. Anyone spots yellow going by? That's probably yellow. So let's bind this to a property called brush. So now we've data bound that, and it doesn't work at design time anymore. And so we can go to our view models folder over here and add a new item. And let's add a Prism item. And let's add a view model. And we could call this smiley and it's gone into the view models folder. We don't need all this stuff that's in here right now, so let's just get rid of it. And let's just add a brush on here. So let's say public brush. Ah. So we'll have a nice red brush. Okay? Let's press F5 on that. We have a nice red brush. So there's a convention again going on in here in that if we look at smiley page .xaml, this is not just a page from the WinRT framework, it's a visual state aware page from Prism. So they're using their own base class there. And there's a specific attach property that's been put in here by default. View model locator automatically wire up the view model. So there's a convention being applied that says, hey, if your view is called smiley page, we will try and find a type called smiley page view model. We'll create it, we'll set it as the data context for that view, and we'll bind the two things together. So there's just a convention that's going on there. And once again, we can override that convention, and we will override that convention as we go along. Is this making sense? Simpler? Okay. We'll move away from smiley faces at this point. But I thought it was useful just as a way of kind of showing how some of this stuff works. So let's get rid of this smiley page view and the smiley page view model. And let's go ahead and add a new view, the view that we saw on the PowerPoint. So let's go to our views here. And actually, I want to add a few more folders into the project. So let's add a few more things in here. I'm going to, at some point, build out some kind of model. So let's have a model folder in here. And let's go and add a new folder for service as well. Build a service a little bit later on. And I've got some images. I need an images folder. Let's just add an images folder here. And I think those are on my desktop here, so let me just find those images. Let's copy those. You saw these on the slide. These people all come out of PowerPoint. If you search for people in PowerPoint, you can get these images, and they're royalty-free, so I use them. And they go into that folder there. And then I also have some resources. So let's just copy that file and paste that in here. Those resources are just a few strings. So there's some labels and some various other bits and pieces. They're just a few strings. There's nothing too complicated going on inside there. OK, so let's create that contact page view. So let's go to our view here and let's add a new item. And we can use Prism again. And I can call this thing contacts page.xaml. So that's going to be my view for that thing, and we'll add it in. Okay? In this particular case, I'm going to get rid of all the stuff that Prism gives me. We'll get rid of all this. Ah, dear me. Sorry. But notice that I am leaving this auto wire view model set to true. So we are leaving that set to true. I've got a snippet to provide the UI here. It's not much UI, but it's something that would take me 10 or 15 minutes to drag drop. So I've got a snippet for my UI. In fact, I've got quite a lot of snippets for different pieces. So what we could do is insert this contacts page here, and that gets thrown in. And if we have a look at what this is, it's nothing too complicated. So there's just a title, which is going to pick up its value from one of those resources that I threw into the project. So that's fine. That's just going to do that. And then we've got a grid view, and the grid view is bound to a property called contacts. So it's going to pick up a collection of contacts from somewhere. And for each item, it's going to display a button that is data bound to a command called invoke contact command. So when you tap on the item, it's going to do something. Then there's an image, and the image is bound to a property called contact image URI. And then there's some text bound to contact last name and first name. So it's pretty simple. We're going to have a grid. It's going to have buttons in it. The buttons have data-bound commands. And inside each button, there's a picture with a first name and a last name. And it's all data-bound. And there's no dependency from this view on anything. You know, this view just stands alone. You can plug whatever you want behind it. It doesn't know. It doesn't care. It's just a view. It's as simple as that, really. So we need to get to the point where we've got a view model that sits behind this, and we have to add a few bits and pieces in to get to that level. So let's try and do that. Let me just close this file down. The first thing I want is my model, and my model is pretty simple. So let's go to my model folder over here, and we'll add a class. I'll call this contact.c#. And again, I've got a quick snippet to make this much, much simpler than that. So I decided to say, hey, a contact has an ID, an image URI, a first name, a last name, a date of birth. So quite simple. You'll notice that I'm deriving from a class called Bindable Base. If you've used binding in .NET generally, but in WPF or Silverlight or Windows Runtime or anything, you'll know there's a need to implement an interface called iNotifyPropertyChanged, and that's what this gives you. So if we just jump to this with F12, this is Prism implementing iNotifyPropertyChanged. I don't think anyone in the world should be having to implement iNotifyPropertyChanged in 2014, really. It's there in Prism, so you can use their implementation. So that's the model. Simple enough? Yeah, cool. I need something to load and save those from the disk, so I want a little service. We'll add a class. I'll call it Contact Persistence Service. And again, I've got a snippet in order to make this a little bit more simple. And so I'm defining a few things here. This is a reasonably big snippet. Firstly, I'm defining an interface to define the shape of my persistence service. And it's fairly simple, I hope. You can ask it, hey, give me all of the contacts, and do it asynchronously because we're on Windows Runtime and you have to do things asynchronously on Windows Runtime. So give me a list of all the contacts. Or when we get onto that details page later on, give me a specific contact based on their ID. Or save me a contact. And it's as simple as that. It's probably easiest to show what the thing actually does. So if we look at one of these implementations here on this service, let's just scroll down. So get contact by ID, what it actually does is it creates some dummy data based on the ID. So you get first name one, last name one, and so on and so forth. That's all it does. And then it looks to see, can it find a file called 1.xml, 2.xml, 3.xml, 4.xml, whatever the ID is, it looks for a file. And if it can find that file, it will try and deserialize saved data out of that file. So if we've stored some information about contact 4, we've just stuck it into a file called 4.xml and we read it back. And if we can do that, we return that contact back. So we either return the dummy data or the real data from a file. And then, of course, we've got a save method. And the save method simply takes the contact, opens up a file, 1234xml, and writes that data into that file. And then the function that gets all the data, really, it just goes to this folder here in the application package. It enumerates all the pictures it can find in there, pulls out their numbers, and then calls the other API to say, hey, can you get picture 1, picture 2, picture 3, picture 4, picture 5, picture 6? And that's pretty much all it does. So it's a service. It's very, very simple. It doesn't do too much. It's abstracted by an interface. Let's have a look at that. So what I need is a couple of view models to put on top of these things. So let's just create those two view models. One is going to be pretty simple. So I'll call this contact view model. Let's just throw in a quick implementation of this. And the contact view model is deriving from a Prism class called ViewModel. So let's take a quick look at that before we go any further. And you'll notice, well, it's just a bindable base, so it's just picking up notify property change. But it has one other thing on it. This is a Prism interface. We make this view model navigation aware, and we will look at that later on. Can the view model be aware as the user is moving around the application? And we'll take a look at that later on. It's something that's quite a useful thing to have. So we derive from ViewModel. We make available a particular contact, and we have a command for what to do when somebody taps on that contact. You'll notice that we're using a class called delegate command. This comes from Prism. So it's an implementation of iCommand, so you don't have to build your own. And what it's going to do in this case, it's going to call that function down there when anyone invokes that command. That's the view model that's going to be used for all of the six contacts on the screen. We then need a view model that presents those all six contacts on the screen. So we'll write one more view model in here. And this would need to be, just change that to prism. The contacts page view model. Let's just get rid of this and throw in a snippet to replace it. So this is also a view model. You've seen that already. Skip this for 1 second. It surfaces a collection of contact view models. So what this class is going to do is it's going to hit the persistence service. It says, give me all the contacts. And then for all those contacts, it's going to wrap a view model around every one of them and put them into a collection. It's going to take the models, wrap a view model around them, and put them into a collection. That's what it's going to do. The way it does that, of course, is by using the persistence service. So if we have a look at that, you'll see that there's a constructor here that takes the persistence service and stores it in a member variable. And then we initialize ourselves. I don't really like calling initialization functions inside of constructors, but that's what I'm doing at the moment. And what this function does is it uses the persistence service to get all of the contacts. But then this class needs a way to go from a model to a view model for each one of those items. So the other thing I've passed it at construction time is a factory function that knows how to create a contact view model. We store that. And so when we've got all of the models back from the persistence service, we create a collection by selecting a new view model and setting the contact on it. So we're just going from models to view models via a factory. Okay, great. I think those are all the pieces I want. So if I was to tell my application, you don't start on the smiley page, you start on the contacts page, that might be sort of enough, although it won't be, but it could be. Let's see how we get on. Okay, so we've managed to achieve the right title. It's a major step. There's a problem here. What's happening, of course, is if we take a look at it, we go back to that contacts page view model. Let me put a breakpoint here. So great, Prism is creating the view, it's creating the view model, it's wiring them together, but I need my initialization function called, and it's not being called. Because we're not using this constructor. Prism doesn't know how to do this, it just knows how to do this, so it doesn't work. But that's okay, because once again, we can plug into how that convention is applied, and there's many ways we can plug into how we do this, but here's one. If we go back over to our app.xaml, we could initialize things a little bit differently. We can get rid of that for the minute, I think. I showed you that view model locator tag in the XAML, which was saying automatically wire the view models. Well, we can talk to that class, and we can say, actually, we want to change how things work. So, for instance, if you are looking for the contacts page, and we have to turn it into a string here, then it says, okay, give me a function to create the view model. Okay, we can give it that function. Here's a function that's going to create a new contacts page view model. And that second constructor needs a contact persistence service. So we create one of those, and it also needs a function, I'm sorry for so many lambdas, that knows how to create a contact view model. And if we have anything like enough braces on the screen, we might be overriding the way in which it creates that view model. And so, ideally, it creates the view model just fine, and we get that stuff bound onto the screen. Now, if you were looking at this, and you were thinking, well, to be honest, it's starting to look like you're wandering into the realms of inversion of control and containers. You're right, and I probably wouldn't do this in reality. I would probably use an IOC container. But I wanted to show you that you don't have to use an IOC container with Prism, and you can use any IOC container with Prism. So let's not do this way. Let's use an IOC container. Let's get rid of this. So instead of doing this, I'm going to add a reference over here. And the IOC container that I generally use is AutoFac. So I'm going to go find AutoFac and install AutoFac. People use AutoFac? One or two over there. I mean, I think most IOC containers kind of look the same, so hopefully if you don't use it, it won't kind of freak you out in any way. And so what we need to do is we need to build up our IOC container. And again, rather than sort of bang out lots of code in doing that, I've got a little snippet to build up my IOC container. Let me just resolve a few things before we talk about this snippet. Excuse me. Okay, so we've resolved some things. AutoFac has an idea of a container builder which builds up the container for you. So what we're saying is, hey, if anyone needs a navigation service, Prism has one. So make use of it. We'll come back to this later on, hopefully. If anyone needs to load up resources from resource files, give them a service that does that. If they need a session management service, give them a service that does that. This is my stuff now. If you need a contact persistence service, here's one. If you need the contacts view model or the contacts page view model, here they are. We build up that container, and then we tie it into Prism. We say, whatever you're trying to resolve, just ask the container. He knows. Ask him. He'll work it out for you. And so ideally, if we run this back around, we're still working quite nicely, but now we're bootstrapped by AutoFac rather than doing things ourselves, which is, you know, a choice you can make, but we're back and we're working quite nicely. So on top of this, let's implement a details page. So the thing I want to do with that is the first thing, here's the contact view model. When you invoke a contact, I want to navigate to a details page. That means, sure. Well, we haven't needed that in there at this point. We could make it navigation aware. We will make... Yes, I like what you're talking about there. That's a good point. Let's go back. I like that. Okay, so the contacts page view model. Currently what we do is we construct it and then we initialize it. I would like to make it navigation aware. That's a good idea. So let's get rid of this. We could override on navigated to. I like the way you're thinking on this one. And we could say, okay, now initialize. So this is nicer because we construct the view, we construct the view model, and then the framework says to the view model, you are being navigated to, do something. And we say, okay, cool, let's do something. And we should still be initializing. Very good, I like that. That was great, thank you. That was great. And that's exactly how I would do it. So the view model knows as you're navigating to it. Now, normally, if you look at Windows Store applications, it's always the view that knows how to navigate, and it's always the view that knows it's being navigated to. But to have that on the view model is actually really, really useful. So, yeah, that's cool. Well, the way that this is working at the moment, we've only got one view, and we can't navigate away or to or from it. But what will happen if we go away from it and back? This page would not be cached, so the view would get a new view, and the way we've set up our IOC container, there would be a new view model, so you would need to initialize it, because otherwise it won't display anything. Now, you could do some smart things with caching, but we're not doing those right now. But it's a good point. So we were trying to navigate to a details page. So what I need to do is teach this view model about a navigation service. And we can wire one of those in. So let's just define a navigation service, just as a member variable here. We'll apply one as a parameter into the constructor. Autofact will inject that for me automatically. So we can save it off. And then when we actually tap on one of these things, we could say this.navigationService.navigate details. And we need to pass which contact we're displaying the details of, so this.contact.id would work quite nicely, and we pass across to that details page. Let's make a details page from Prism. So here's our details page again. Very much in the interest of time, let's get rid of that UI. And let me throw in a snippet for a different UI. So here's my details page. There's an application bar at the bottom of the screen with a button binding to a save command. When you've made some changes, you can save things. And then what we've got is a title at the top of the screen, just bound to first name and last name. An image that's bound to image URI. And then some text boxes and a date picker that are bound to first name, last name, and date of birth. There's another control which I'll come back to later on if we get time to look at that as well. So we're doing some binding on this thing. We need a view model to sit behind this page. So let's just have a view model to sit behind this page. We'll call this, just add a view model in here, details page view model. And again, I'll replace this with a snippet. So here's our view model. It needs a persistent service, which Autofact will inject for it. It surfaces the contact. It has a save command. Now, we set up this command here with two parameters. The first one is the function to call when somebody clicks save, and the second one is the function to call to check. Is it possible to click save? Should we enable this command or not? And that's this function here, canSave. And essentially, I have a little Boolean that I keep around to say whether you can save or not. We'll come back to that in 1 second. When somebody saves, we talk to the persistent service, and we ask it to save the contact. And then we say, well, if you've just saved the data, there's no data to save, so you can't save. And we tell the command, you need to refresh your view as to whether you can save or not, because we've just changed the value. That's all part of iCommand, effectively. Coming back to the gentleman's point, this view model needs to know when it's navigated to. It picks up that integer we passed as a navigation parameter. It uses the persistent service to load the contact, puts that onto something that's data-bound onto the screen. And then from there on in, if anyone changes a property on that contact, that data is dirty, so you can save. And so anytime that happens, we change our ability to save. Cool. So we just need to register this class with AutoFact, so we just need to make sure that we say that's now part of our container. And ideally, if we run this back up, where did we go? Sorry. Oh, that doesn't look too clever. So we've run this back up. We should be able to navigate into one of these contacts, navigate across to that second page. As we change things here, let's say this lady's called Sarah, you might notice that the save button enables. When we click save, the save button disables. Obviously, if we go back, should have changed the other piece of text, but if we go with last name, let's say Smith. It's a very English name. Let's wander back out of here. Then we're making those changes live into that view model. So that's all very nice. There's a bunch of things, though, here that don't quite work. So one of those things would be, for instance, if you've looked at Windows 8, 8.1 applications, you'll know that they go through a suspend, resume, and potentially terminate lifecycle. And that's something that developers typically have to to think about and do something with. So let's take a look at this. Let's say, just to make this obvious, let's go into this first picture here. And let's say that I'm editing this, and let's say this lady's called Jill Jones, and we specify 2nd of February, March 1971. So we're making these edits, and then Windows comes along and suspends and terminates this application. So let's go over to the debugger and suspend and terminate the application. And it's dead. And then the user taps on the application's tile to bring it back. And as a developer, you should be putting that back in the state that it was in. Now, Prism gets 50% here because you're back on the right page, which is good. We've preserved your navigation history, so that was good. But the data that the user was typing is gone, and that's not so good. So what would be nice is if we had some way of preserving that. And of course, you can do that manually in a Windows Store app, but Prism has specific features for this. So as an example of how we can do this, let's go back to our view model over here. This is the details page view model. And it has a contact. And we can say, this is restorable state. We're saying to Prism, this matters to this view model. I want you to suspend, write it out, and bring it back for me. In order to do that, it needs to know how to serialize a contact. And we have to teach it a little bit. And there's an override in our application class here. Register known types for serialization. So what we could do is we could just say this.sessionService.registerKnownType and teach it about that type. Let's try running this back up. So we can navigate into one of these things. Let's try this one again. We said this lady might be called Jill. She might be called Jones. We said 2nd of something, 1971. And then we go out and we suspend and terminate the application. Run it back up. And we're back exactly where we were. And that's a really nice way of getting around suspend, terminate. Did we do it wrong? Oh. You're right too, aren't you? Okay, we're not back exactly where we were, but that's my bug. And I should have marked that. Yeah, okay. So I have a bug to fix there, don't I? But that wasn't Prism's fault, that was my fault. But I think you'll notice that the save button is enabled if you look carefully. All right, I've got a bug. Another thing that would be nice here would be if we could do something around validation around these fields. That would be another nice thing we can do, and that's another feature of Prism. So let's just take a quick look at that. Sure.
Serialization. Why is it not enough that contact is serializable?
Because if you know, when you construct a serializer in like a data contract serializer, when you construct one of those things, you have to give it a list of types to know about. So Prism is constructing one of those on your behalf, and it has to give it types. So it gives it types. And so you have to list your types. If you look in the AdventureWorks sample, which we may get to, they list a long list of types for serialization. So it's just something you just got to do, unfortunately. It'd be nice if you didn't. And it doesn't force me to... I've not had to attribute contact in any way. I've just left contact is... Contact is just a plain class right now. So there's nothing attributed on there whatsoever. Validation. Yeah, so let's have a quick look. Actually, we'll replace this model class here. So if I get rid of this contact... Oh, no, it's the model class, isn't it? So I can replace this with a second version of this. And I've just changed its base class from bindable base to validatable bindable base. If we take a look at that base class, it's a Prism class, it adds the notion of, well, essentially, something that knows about the errors on that type, whether validation switched on or not, when the errors on that type change, a function that can get you all the errors for the type, because what this framework does is it tends to store errors on a per property basis. So the errors for the first name, the errors for the last name, the errors for the date of birth, but there's a method to call to get all of the errors. And a function that you can manually call to ask for validation, although the framework will automatically do validation as property values change. If we reach into this errors property here, it's actually a more complex type, again, with a collection of errors on a per property basis and a change handler. So there's some validation support here. And if you ever looked at sort of validation support, I think in WPF or as of Silverlight, I think 4.5, one of those two things, it's very similar to the interfaces that you would see in those frameworks. But those interfaces don't exist in WinRT, and so Prism is doing its own work here. So what we've done in the model, where's my model, is on the first name property, I've made this a required property. I've applied a regular expression, and I've also got a little bit of custom validation, which we'll talk about in a minute. I've done a similar thing on last name, and on the date of birth, I didn't really know what to do, so I just applied a range attribute saying between 1950 and 2013. The custom validation is just a way of showing you that you can do custom validation. And it runs this function here, which basically says you can have any name you like as long as it's not mine. So I'm just saying that's invalid, just as an example of applying some rule, you know, some rule. You can't be me. It's not a good place to be anyway. The other thing that I added to this class was this property here of all errors. And I just called the base class to get one simple list of all the errors. That's what I was trying to do. And whenever the errors change, all the errors change. So we've added this now to the model. If we go to our view model for a second, I'm not fixing the bug that the gentleman pointed out over there, but if we go to the view model for the details page, can save is now a little bit more complicated than it was before, because we probably shouldn't let you save unless this.contact.allerrors.count is zero. And as those errors change, we need to tell the command to enable disable itself. So somewhere down here, we could say this.contact.errorsChanged we could say this.save command dot make sure it's still okay to save or not to save. Now, one thing I didn't really show you back in the XAML for this page was that I already have a simple control that is data binding to all errors. So what should happen if we run this back around and choose somebody here, you can already see we've got some simple errors popping up at the bottom from the regular expression validation. If we miss out a name, then we've got errors from the required field validation. But if we fill this in, and actually if we put a bad date of birth, we will get a really ugly message by default, which you wouldn't perhaps want to show to a user, but that's the default error message coming out of that range validation on the date of birth. And one thing we would have to do, coming back to the gentleman's point over here, is we now have to make sure that our errors work nicely with suspend and terminate, so that when you left in an error state, you came back in an error state. I'm not going to persist those things right now, but we should do that too. That would be, I've introduced a second bug, basically. It's getting worse. we should make sure that this thing is not enabling that save button unless the field is valid, which we kind of do, and that works quite nicely. So validation support is something that Prism's got in its toolkit of things for you. If you want to validate stuff, then it's kind of in there. One other thing I'll just show you very quickly. What if we wanted to add a simple sort of confirmation dialogue on this save button down here? So let's just go stop debugging, and let me close a few windows. There's too many things for me open at the moment. And this happens in the details view model. So there's a button here for on save. And let's say I wanted to add a simple confirmation dialog around that. So I think I've got a little function to do that. Let's confirm save. Let me just fix the namespaces on this before we talk about it. So this thing is just essentially putting up a message box saying, do you want to save, yes or no? And then showing that message box asynchronously and returning whether you said yes or no. Let me just fix the squiggly line there by adding a namespace at the top of the file. So now what we could do is we could say, well, actually, no, we can't, because in writing this function, I wanted it to be localizable, so I wanted to be able to load up some string resources from somewhere. And how do I go about loading up string resources? Well, Prism has an interface, iResourceLoader, that you can use to load up your resources. And so if we can inject one of these things in here, I can use that resource loader to get hold of strings, in this case, from my resources file down here, but I don't have to know about where any of that stuff is coming from. And Prism just provides you a resource loading service. It's not a complex thing, but it provides it for you. So what we could do is just change this view model to take a dependency on an iResource loader. And then we could make sure we have a member variable for that. Make sure that we store things away. And then we can call our function that requires that resource loader. So when we come to save, we could say, okay, if we confirm the save, passing it our resource loader. Oh, it's an async function, sorry. If we await that, as long as the user presses yes, then we can do the save. Run that back up. Navigate into here. And those little pieces of text, the labels and the text itself, are coming from resources file, just quite nicely done. You often find yourself deep in some component and you want to load resources. And a resource loading interface is a nice abstraction, just as a way of doing it. One other thing I'll just show you here, sure. Yes.
Very elegant solutions for it on the reactive UI session.
Okay, yeah.
Are there any, do you see problems in integrating reactive UI in Prism?
No, I don't think so. No, I mean, you can mix those two things together if you want to. This is essentially, there is a way to change when that happens. It's your choice. You can make a choice with pretty much, I think, all of the XAML-based frameworks about when you actually push the property value back into the underlying data field. You can do it as the user types if you want to, or the default here is that obviously as you lose focus, you have to think about it. And also that means you have to think about the sort of the last lose of focus away from a control to a button down in the bottom right-hand corner of the screen. So you can change it. I forget what the binding property is called. It's the update source trigger, I think it's called. And you can build a custom one of those that does what you want. You'll find a bunch of articles on the web about doing that, possibly even one written by me. So you can change it, but by default it does do what you suggest. Yeah, so it's when you lose focus. I guess somebody building a framework somewhere has to pick a sensible default, and this is what they went with. But you can change it. So the last thing I was just going to say here, if you remember when we looked at our page way back when, it was, where's my page? Let's just have a look. It was a visual state aware page. And if we have a look at that again with Alt F12, you'll spot that at least what Prism contributes here is the notion of a default layout, a minimum layout. On Windows 8, that'll be either 500 pixels or 320 pixels, the minimum size you specify for your application window, and a portrait layout. So this thing already knows about that, but we haven't taken advantage of it yet. If I make this into a portrait window, you'll notice that it doesn't really do, it's not very nice. I've lost it. It's not particularly friendly. And we could do something a little bit better than that. And Prism is actually trying to fire the right events into our app to say, hey, this thing's gone portrait. What are you going to do about it? And our answer at the moment is nothing. But we could do something. And it's declarative. So it's just a matter of making XAML changes with visual states to switch into the right mode. And so if we look at this page over here, let's just have a look at this. We have a grid here. I can add some visual states. I've already got things kind of set up so that this will sort of work. So what I'm saying here is I've got a portrait layout which involves moving some things around in grids and columns. A few of those, I did them in Blend. And the default layout which involves no changes. So if you run this back around, what we should see, navigate into one of these people, and we get some visual state changes to lay that thing out differently. And as we go back into landscape, we get visuals. I mean, it's pretty simple, but you get visual state changes. We're only doing that on that one page. We aren't doing anything on this page. And you could argue about whether you should or shouldn't do something on that page, but we aren't doing anything there. We're only doing something here to lay that thing out differently. So, kind of quickly, because I spent more time on that than I was intending to, and we've also got a massive complex application to show as well. I'm not going to get through all of that, but let me just illustrate that. And perhaps let's not drop back to slides. Let's just stick in Visual Studio. That's kind of my Hello World sort of demo to show you some of the things that Prism has. But if we were to go and bring up this folder, Prism also ships this AdventureWorks reference implementation. And so what you get here is a lot more stuff than I could show you in a session like this. But fundamentally what you get is a main project that provides a Windows 8.1 application. Let me run it and show you what that looks like. It's a bicycle store. And on the top page here, you get five top categories of products. So you can see we've got some deals, we've got some accessories, we've got some bikes, we've got some clothing, and so on. This supports semantic zoom, so you can navigate that way and drop into components if you want to go that way. It's semantic zoom. It also supports the idea of searching, so we can go and search. I searched for a headset the other day, and that worked okay. And we can navigate to a product and have a look at product details. For these things, they all support, I think, portrait and landscape layout, so you can have a look at how that works as well. And when you're in a set of search results like this, you can flick through those sets of search results. There should be three there, and we can see how that works. Navigate back to our search results, navigate back over here. We can pick something and we can buy it, so we can add this into our shopping cart. And now we've got one of these things in our shopping cart up here, and we can do things like edit the quantities here. So we could say we wanted three of these things rather than one, or we can remove them, and so on and so forth. And we can wander back out of that, and that's still my shopping cart. And they have navigation bars from top and bottom of the screen, so you can pin particular products to your start screen, and you can also navigate home and to your shopping cart from here. You can also, they integrate with settings on Windows 8.1, so you can have a look at their settings and see what they've got over there. And they also integrate, if we pick a particular product, they integrate with sharing. So I can navigate in and share. We could send this in an email, for instance, that I'm going to buy this bike, and I could go and send that out. I'm thinking of buying this bike. What do you think about this bike? That kind of thing. So they do quite a lot in here. Let me close this down. What you've essentially got is the top level Windows 8.1 application project. That's the top level that you've got. If you wander in there, you'll see there's a whole ton of views. So there's a bunch of the views we were just looking at. Specifically, the start page is this page called the hub page here. And if you look at this in the designer, you'll see that's the hub page we were looking at displaying design time data. If in this top level project, you will find that they have a bunch of design time view models specifically to support design time data. I don't think any of their real view models are actually in this project. They're in a separate project, I think. You'll also find a bunch of controls living up here. And you would find our app.xaml. And if we look into our app.xaml, just by the way, sorry, I should have mentioned. These guys are not using AutoFact, they use Unity, which is the IOC container that Patterns and Practices Group builds. So they're using their own IOC container, but we already know you can use other IOC containers. And you will see them building up. Well, they do something slightly different to me in application launch. They support the idea of being launched from the main tile, but also from a secondary tile where somebody has pinned a second tile and you want to jump to a particular product, so they support that. You'll notice here they are registering all their types for serialization, so there's a lot more stuff going on in there. And you'll notice here they are setting up their IOC container. So they've got a lot more types than I had, but fundamentally it's the same idea. They've just got a lot more of it. I don't think there's anything else to... Oh, and I didn't show this in my example. This is where they set up their settings implementation. I didn't have a settings implementation. That's something else that Prism can help you with. So from there, the way this works is that if we just have a look at this, this hub page is automatically wiring up its view model at runtime. And it data binds to this thing called root categories. So those are the top five categories that you get displayed across the screen. Again, taking a sort of vertical slice here, that would live in this UI logic project that they've got, where you'll find lots of view models and various associated pieces. You'll find a bunch of repositories. You'll find a bunch of models, and you'll find a bunch of services. Lots of things in here. If we go and take a look at the hub page view model, this is the one that sits behind that main screen, you'll find that it depends on a product catalog repository, which it uses to get the top five root categories. So it depends on a repository. If you have a look at the repository, product catalog repository, product catalog repository, it depends on, it calls into a sub function. It has a dependency on a caching service, but if things aren't cached, it has a dependency on a product catalog service. And if you look into the product catalog service, somewhere down here, it spins up an HTTP client and goes across to the web service to go and get the product catalogs from the web service. That web service is by default running locally on this machine, and those web services are all part of the project. So what you get up here is essentially two UI projects, a web services project with, this is a separate project where you've got controllers. I got confused by models and things there, where you've got models on the web services side. I was just looking at something else for a minute. So that's the web services project. And then what you also get here is a whole suite of tests for the web services, for the Windows Store apps, and so on and so forth. So you get a whole bunch of tests in there as well. So this is quite a fully fledged, fully featured application. It's got loads of stuff in it, as you can see. We can't, you know, you could spend a good day or something just navigating around what they've built in that application. But I think the nice thing about this, and hopefully this comes across to you in this session, is we played with some pieces, but those same pieces are what they use in this application. It's not conceptually any different. There's just a lot more of it, and it's done in a proper way rather than, excuse me, me playing around in Visual Studio. So I hope you get a flavor of that, and I would strongly encourage you, if you're interested in Prism 2, to dig into that reference implementation. That's what this is. You've seen some of this. We've been in there just a little bit. So kind of summarizing what we've seen, Prism for Windows Runtime is from the Patterns and Practices team. It's there for Windows 8.0, Windows 8.1. It's really for .NET XAML applications where you want to use a model view, view model approach. It provides you a convention-based MVVM framework, implements things like property change notification, iCommand. It also implements things like wiring up view models to views. You can or you cannot plug in an IOC container if you want to work that way. And then we saw some extra pieces like navigation awareness, suspend and terminate awareness, albeit with my bug. We saw things like validation awareness, a little bit about loading resources, and some other bits and pieces. But all of that, for me, I would still come back to where I started at the front and say, yes, there's lots of code here. I would marry it up with their book, their documentation, and their guide as to why they made certain choices, why you would or wouldn't make certain choices, and how you would use this framework for building your application. So I would still say, if you're interested in this stuff, get the framework, try it out, play around yourself, and read that documentation about how this stuff works. I'm right out of time. Thanks for your patience in that. I know we had a lot of code. I know we had a lot of demos and changed a few things as we went along. I hope you found it useful and found it a good session. There are prizes apparently to be won if you feedback via techdaysapp.nl, so feel free to take that link and please provide feedback. You can feedback to me face-to-face if you want and say, that was terrible, please never speak to me again, or not. You can feedback on Twitter, that's a little bit more anonymous, and that kind of thing. You're always free to send me a mail or anything like that. I hope you enjoy the rest of your day here, and thanks a lot for listening. Thank you.